Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the ADA Distance Learning Center conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Peter Berg, ADA Technical Assistant Coordinator of the Great Lakes ADA and IT Center. Mr. Berg, you may begin.
All right. Thank you very much, Crystal, and welcome everyone to the ADA Distance Learning Series, a collaborative effort of the 10 Regional Disability Business and Technical Assistance Centers, DBTACs. We truly appreciate your support of the ADA Distance Learning Series for the 2002-2003 season. You can find out more information about the Americans with Disabilities Act and also about accessible electronic and information technology by contacting your regional ADA center at 1-800-949-4232. By contacting your regional center, you can find out information about our September 16th distance learning session, which was entitled Best Practices in Accessible Electronic and Information Technology Policy. On the 16th of September, we will be joined by a representative of Access IT out of the University of Washington and also by representatives of the Information Technology Technical Assistance and Training Center, ITTATC, out of Georgia Tech. And they will help us look at what are the best practices, what policies are out there for addressing ENIT before ENIT is even purchased or before the ENIT is developed, and ensuring that persons with disabilities using assistive technology and other ways of accessing people with disabilities have the same level of access to the ENIT that other individuals have. The 2002-2003 season will end on September 16th, and we will kick off the 2003-2004 season in October. You can find out information about that new season and the schedule for the and topics for those sessions by contacting your regional ADA center in the upcoming weeks. There will also be information sent out to regular subscribers to the distance learning, so please stay tuned. You can also find information regarding the schedule for the next season at the Great Lakes website at ADAGreatLakes.org. Also, currently on the Great Lakes website, today's audio conference is being real-time captioned, and you can click on the link there to access the real-time captioning that is taking place. You can also find transcripts from past sessions on the Great Lakes website located at www.adagreatlakes.org. All righty. On to today's session. We are very fortunate to have with us today Betty Siegel. Betty Siegel is the Accessibility Manager at the JFK Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. Last August, Betty joined us to look at ticketing policies and what is taking place in the performing arts and how are they meeting their obligations to provide individuals with disabilities who need accessible seating locations, a variety of sight lines and access to various price levels. Well, today Betty has agreed to join us and talk about ensuring access to all people through the provision of auxiliary aids and services, through the provision of sign language interpreters, closed captioning, assistive listening devices, and providing materials in alternative formats. So, Betty, before we get started, I'd just like to thank you because we appreciate your time and effort that you've given to us, and I'm sure that there will be lots of individuals who will have questions for you. But at this time, I'd like to turn it over, everyone, to Betty Siegel.
Thanks very much. As Peter knows, I'm extremely nervous about this presentation, and I am not the kind of person that gets nervous easily. And I was trying to figure out why I was so nervous, and I realized that I really think that, Peter, in the future you should do video phone conferences with to ensure effective communication for nervous presenters like me who feed off of a live audience and find it frustrating when I can't see who I'm speaking to. But let me start off by talking briefly about the Kennedy Center's approach to ensuring effective communication through the provision of auxiliary aids and services. I'm going to use the Kennedy Center a little bit as a case study and give you insight into my own personal approach to making theaters and performing arts accessible. And then I'd like to open it up as quickly as possible to questions. So if I don't address your specific issue or concern in my formal presentation, then I'm sure we'll get to it when we get to the Q&A. So the topic today is ensuring effective communication through the provision of auxiliary aids and services. And I'd like to start with a brief definition because we don't often know what it means, effective communication. In a nutshell, effective communication is the provision of auxiliary aids and services that make orally delivered materials available to people who are deaf or hard of hearing and make visually delivered materials available to people who are blind or have low vision. Examples of things that would be considered to be auxiliary aids and services include, but are not limited to, qualified interpreters, computer-aided transcription services, captioning, assistive listening devices, audio recordings, Braille, large print. But is that the right place to start by just listing the types of auxiliary aids and services that we could be providing for our patrons with disabilities? I don't think so. My firm belief is that to provide effective communication, you have to start with two things. And those two things are, first and foremost, the community. And by this, I mean the community of people who are supposed to benefit from and use the auxiliary aids and services that we in the theater and performing arts and cultural arts centers provide. And secondly, I think we have to start with making a clear commitment to accessibility and then to developing policies and procedures that support that commitment. I want to start with community. I like to get people with disabilities from the local community involved. What works in Austin, Texas doesn't work in Washington, D.C. And most importantly for you, you need to know what your community wants and expects. I want to know what my community wants, what they like, don't like about what the Kennedy Center is doing, and I want to get a gauge on what they consider to be the most important thing I can do. This helps me because it helps me set my priorities. It helps me to better use my resources, which include my staff time, my energy, and for many of us, a very important resource, our money. There are traditional ways of getting the community involved. By establishing advisory committees, almost every book that you'll ever pick up and read about providing access in a performing arts environment will encourage you to put together an advisory committee. But honestly, I found when I came here to the Kennedy Center in D.C. that it was really difficult to get a standing advisory committee together. Everyone's so busy. Meeting once a month was almost impossible to schedule, juggling people's schedules. And what's more, the issues that I had to deal with popped up daily, and I frequently didn't have a lot of turnaround time in which to make the decisions. I couldn't wait for the advisory committee meeting in 2 weeks when the issue was in my lap today. So here at the Kennedy Center, I've moved away from the concept of the traditional advisory committee. And instead, I use task forces, and I take advantage of email. Let me explain that. What I do is identify knowledgeable people with disabilities in the community that have a global perspective on accessibility. I try to find people who love the performing arts. And more importantly, I try to find people who have come to the Kennedy Center so they have a clear and personal relationship with the building and the programs that I represent. I also like to take advantage of the many national associations that serve people with disabilities and my contacts with professionals in the field from across the nation. I'm lucky to live in D.C. A lot of national organizations, Paralyzed Veterans of America, the American Association of People with Disabilities, National Association for the Deaf, have offices here, and I can tap their resources and their people to help me make decisions about how we provide effective communication at the Kennedy Center. But people outside of D.C. have the advantages of their own local communities and resources, like the independent living centers that are in most communities, affiliates of organizations like Self-Help for the Hard of Hearing, and other organizations that are local, mayor's committees, governor's committees on people with disabilities. I encourage everyone to contact those individuals and get them involved in your policy and planning procedures. I set up task forces for very specific concrete projects. For example, I have a task force made up of four individuals who are all wheelchair users who've agreed to come in on an as-needed basis to be a part of the design and review process for all the renovations and architectural changes that are made around the center. Another task force I put together only met twice, and it was made up of people who were blind or had low vision who agreed to come in and critique the readability of our new signs that were we had samples of that would be going up around the building. My email advisors are ones that I contact when I have a specific and immediate issue crop up, like the time I got a request to provide a tactile interpreter for a patron who is deafblind, or when we had the opportunity to switch interpreted performances from Tuesday night to Friday night, and I needed to know right away, how do I find a tactile interpreter? What kind of provisions would I need to make for that interpreter and for that patron? And in the second case, I needed to know right away whether my deaf community here in Washington, D.C. would be more supportive of performances on Friday night than they would be on Tuesday night. I also frequently ask through email for comments on new policies or procedures that the Kennedy Center is developing, and these email advisors help me set priorities and determine how to best use my resources. In addition to the task forces and emails, my email advisors, I make it a point to go out to community meetings, talk to people, constantly solicit feedback and recommendations. There are numerous improvements that we've made here at the Kennedy Center based on community recommendations, things like setting up a specific customer service phone line that people with disabilities can call so they don't have to go through the regular phone tree that other callers go through. Another recommendation that we've taken quite seriously from the community is a recommendation to upgrade equipment for our assistive listening systems. A third recommendation that came straight from the community was for the Kennedy Center to try and offer captioning for our performances. This level of community involvement is what I feel keeps the Kennedy Center on track and constantly improving the types of services, accommodations, auxiliary aids, and enhancing our communication with our patrons. Now, the second thing that I mentioned that I think is really important to ensuring effective communication is a clear commitment to accessibility, and then to developing policies and procedures that support that commitment. I'm going to use the Kennedy Center as an example here. The Kennedy Center has a general policy on accessibility that's quite simple. And we came up with this policy after about a month or two of going back and forth and back and forth and having policy statements that were 2 pages long, 10 pages long, 2 paragraphs long. And we finally just decided, no, really, our policy should follow universal design concepts and be simple. So our policy, our general statement is, we welcome people with disabilities. Now, not only is that a clear and simple statement of our commitment, it pervades all of our other policies and procedures. It also defines our attitude towards our patrons with disabilities, that we welcome and we value them. We go on and state, in our policy, our general policy, that we strive for accessibility and that our work is ongoing to ensure that all programs, performances, events, and facilities are fully accessible. I think this is really important because it's the part of our policy statement that guarantees that I will always have a job here, which is that accessibility is never done. I know that arts administrators really want to say, there, we have audio description, we're finished, we never have to worry about that again. But that's not the way accessibility works. It is an ongoing effort and a striving for constantly improving. So when we talk about striving for accessibility, we recognize that creating access is an ongoing process, that we're never finished, that there will always be room for improvements and refinements, and that we recognize that we may not be fully accessible right now, but that we're darn sure going to try to be more accessible in the future. The other thing that I try to do with accessibility and policies and procedures, aside from allowing the welcoming statement to infuse them all, is I use what I call the equitability test on all of our policies. When we develop a policy and a procedure, I ask myself, is this providing people with disabilities the same level of accommodation that our non-disabled patrons expect? And if not, is it as close as we can get it? So those are the two things that I think are really important to consider before you even begin going into the practical, everyday provision of auxiliary aids and services and effective communication. Is you must get the community involved in the process, and you must find out from them whether what you're doing is what they want, or you're going to be very frustrated because they won't come and they won't use them because they don't want what you're providing. So get them involved to ensure that you're providing something your community wants. Then secondly, make the commitment and start developing your policies and procedures based on that commitment of inclusion of people with disabilities and welcoming them into your environment. Now, real briefly, I'm going to run through a list of the auxiliary aids and services that the Kennedy Center routinely provides for our patrons with disabilities. This might get a little boring, and I'm hoping that when I'm done with these lists that we can jump right to the Q&A, and you all can start asking, and we can start a dialogue on things related to these accommodations, other accommodations that you've heard about, or more details on any of these. So for our patrons who are blind or have low vision, at the Kennedy Center, we have in place the following basic services. One is something called curb to seat. We have doormen on duty at the front doors, starting 1 hour before showtime, who will assist any of our patrons with disabilities to get from the curb to the theater. And at the theater, we have ushers who are trained to assist people to their seats. This is important for our patrons who are blind and have low vision because the building's big and it's confusing. And if you haven't been a frequent patron, you may not know how to get from point A to point B. And so the doormen are available and they're assigned to assist our patrons to get from the curb to the theater. And once at the theater, the ushers are trained on using sighted guide techniques and how to escort patrons who are blind or have low vision. We trained the volunteer tour guides here at the Kennedy Center to give touch tours, how to audio describe the artwork on the tour, how to audio describe the theater space. And we put together a package of tactile models and drawings that patrons could use to orient themselves to the center. We made a commitment back 4 years ago when I started working here to produce all the playbills for all performances and events in large print and braille. I think I must have been nuts. The Kennedy Center has up to 3,000 events a year, most of which have playbills. We have a core group of 5 volunteers who collectively put in about 40 hours a week to produce every single playbill at the Kennedy Center in large print and in braille. Luckily, we're able to do this in-house through our document center, which print the large prints. And we have Braille software and a very hard-working embosser that we use to produce all of our Braille. So now our patrons who are blind or have low vision can show up and expect to get what the rest of us take for granted, which is a playbill in an accessible format. We trained an in-house group of staff and volunteers to provide audio description. We continue to schedule and advertise specific performances as being audio described, but we also strongly encourage our patrons who are blind or have low vision to take advantage of our on-request services. Our policy is to ask for at least 2 weeks advance notice, but because we have staff who are trained as describers, we make every effort and are often able to accommodate requests on very short notice. We've done extensive training with all the sales services staff so that they understand how to accommodate our patrons who are blind or who have low vision. And we've established a free monthly email audio description theater alert. Once a month, we send out a list of the upcoming audio described performances and events at the Kennedy Center. And then we also, as a courtesy to the other performing arts organizations in the area, include their audio described performances. So you get one monthly alert that tells you about everything that's being audio described around the Washington, D.C. area. That's what we provide primarily for our patrons who are blind and have low vision. I'm going to go into another list now and try to finish it up relatively quickly for the types of auxiliary aids and services we provide for our patrons who are deaf and hearing impaired. We did extensive testing of and improvements on our assistive listening equipment. We make sure that we have equipment that can accommodate those patrons with mild hearing loss, as well as those with a more severe hearing loss through the use of induction neck loops and patch cords for cochlear implants. We have regular annual trainings with all of the ushers who are responsible for handing out and distributing the assistive listening devices so that they can assist our patrons in determining what combination or coupling of equipment will work best with or without a patron's own hearing aids or if the patron has no hearing aids. There's a TTY in all of our sales offices, instant charge, group sales, and subscriptions. And in addition, we installed a TTY in a central location on one of our public pay phones. We train our staff on how to make and take TTY calls, as well as on how to make and take relay calls. We regularly schedule interpreted performances of everything that's in our theater season. And we provide sign language interpreters upon request for all other performances. This includes performances in our youth and family series, school shows, Millennium Stage, which is nightly, Sheer Madness, etc. Once again, our policy is to require 2 weeks advance notice to provide an interpreter, but because of the relationships we've developed with the interpreting community during the 4 years I've been here, we will make every effort to provide interpreters and can sometimes accommodate a request on a very short notice. We also provide tactile interpreting for our patrons who are deaf, blind, and cued speech for patrons who use it upon request. A few years ago, following in the footsteps of several other theaters around the country, we started providing open captioning. We treat these the same way we treat sign interpreted performances by scheduling some shows to have captioning and providing it upon request for those other performances that aren't scheduled. We have identified those ushers who know sign language and asked them to work the interpreted performances, and we train the rest of the ushering staff and sales service staff on basic communication techniques like writing things down facing the patron. We've done extensive training with the sales service staff on accommodating our patrons who are deaf or hard of hearing. And once again, we now have a free subscription email monthly that we call the Sign Interpreted Caption Performance Theater Alert that goes out to over 600 emails to promote interpreted and captioned performances at the Kennedy Center and theaters around the metropolitan area. That's pretty much the list that I came up with of things that the Kennedy Center considers to be basic accommodations and services. I'm going to wrap it up with a story about Boy Scouts. As you know, the Boy Scout motto is to be prepared. And when the Boy Scout founder was asked, what do you mean, be prepared, he responded by saying, why, be prepared for any old thing. And I have to say that I think that the Kennedy Center is an arts institution that's decided that it's going to be prepared for any old thing that comes up.
Excellent. Thank you, Betty. Crystal, if you would come in and give instructions on how individuals can ask questions right now.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. If you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
All right. While we're waiting for the questions to line up there, when Betty and I were talking about the session, she said she didn't want to bore people or seemed like she was bragging about the Kennedy Center with what they do because of the resources that they have. But it is quite impressive that you do put the resources forward to do what you do in ensuring equal access for people with disabilities. Could you talk a little bit more about the descriptive performances that you provide and what kind of training you had to get for your staff in order to be able to provide that?
Well, audio description was started, there's a debate in the community as to whether it was started in California or started here in Washington, D.C. I'm aware of the D.C. History, which is that it started in 1981 at Arena Stage with Cody and Margaret Fansteel from the Washington Ear. And in Washington, D.C., the audio description at performing arts centers has always been provided by volunteers, and it's always been provided through volunteers trained by the Washington Ear. When the Kennedy Center decided to go from a service that was scheduled to an upon-request service as well, we realized we were going to stress out the resources of the Washington Ear and decided to train our own audio describers in-house. And we asked the Fansteels to come and do a weekend-long training with six staff and volunteers at the Kennedy Center. And then that was a year ago. And since that time, we've done monthly trainings. We bring in people who are blind from the community. We watch videotapes and give each other feedback. We ask other trainers around the country to come and talk to us about providing audio description. And because of that, we're able to do, upon request, with very little notice, because I can just call a staff member and say, are you available tonight? We have a patron from out of town who's requesting the service. So one weekend of really intense training and then ongoing training has been really important to making a quality service.
Excellent. Anyway,
I apologize. First question comes from the line of Rick Edwards.
All righty. Good afternoon. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Go ahead.
Good. I've got a question for you. First of all, thank you for your time and being here. We are actually out here. Have you ever had anyone arrive and say they had an attendant aide show up with them and indicate that the ADA requires you to allow that attendant in for free?
I'm going to take your question, if you don't mind, and twist it a little bit,
okay.
which is that I can't say that we've had exactly the situation you've described show up, but we do have people who attend the theater routinely with personal care attendants, and so we have developed a policy and procedures for handling that. Our policy at the Kennedy Center is that every person who is in the theater must have a ticket. That's our policy. And the way we apply that to PCAs is that when a person has a PCA who's medically necessary, and wants that person to be in the theater with them, they must have a ticket, and we provide them with a half-price ticket. The other part of that is we also have people who have PCAs who they don't need in the theater with them, in which case we provide them with a ticket that allows them into the theater to get the patron comfortable, set up, and then the PCA waits in the lobby, and once the intermission's starts, they go back into the theater, and at the end of the performance, they go back into the theater. This is coming out of a philosophy that's based on something kind of simple. You know, if I'm a person and I go into a clothing store and I ask if I can buy a dress, I can't then ask for my PCA to have a dress for free. They benefit from the product, and my product is a show. And the thing I have to sell is that person's being able to see that show. And so I don't personally buy into the philosophy that a PCA has to be free. I don't think that there's anything in the law, and let me just say this really quick, I am not a lawyer, okay? I'm not a lawyer, so you should check this, but I don't think anything that I've seen has ever supported the concept of allowing PCAs in for free, but I do think that you need to have policies and procedures in place to handle the issue of a PCA.
Right. You're correct. There's nothing that requires that in your policy of providing half-price tickets for medically necessary attendance, is, you know, goes above and beyond what Title III would require of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rick. One thing I wanted to mention real quick before we bring up our next question is something that you mentioned several times during your presentation and even in responding to my first question, and that was volunteers. And you make extensive use of volunteers. And can you just talk a little bit more about that? Because, you know, there are theaters that may not have the resources out there, but there are volunteers out in the community that can assist with a lot of providing effective communication.
I love my volunteers. There is no way that I would be able to do half of what I do without the use of the volunteers. Now, one thing we have to remember is that managing and coordinating volunteers is time-consuming. It does. You have to have the resources and the energy to commit to that. But once you do, you multiply your efforts by however many volunteers you have. And I think that we've found here at the Kenney Center that with training and with the commitment that volunteers bring, they are very effective in helping to support us in providing accommodations. And we even find that we end up with a lot of volunteers who have disabilities themselves who want to give back to the community through their work here at the Kenney Center.
That's great. Crystal, can we have our next question, please?
Yes, Mr. Berg. Our next question comes from the line of Lori Lake.
Go ahead, Lori.
Yes, good afternoon. We had a question regarding how do you recommend setting up closed captioning in local movie theaters? That was a topic of discussion in our group, the lack of closed captioning in movie theaters.
Well, there are a lot of different ways that communities across the nation have approached convincing movie theaters to provide captioning. One is, you know, through the lawsuit way. If you don't do this, we'll sue you. And a lot of court cases have been bouncing around that have tested that approach. In Austin, Texas right now, there's an organization, the local VSA Arts Texas, has actually gotten together with a movie chain in the area, and I like this approach much better because I'm a collaborator. I tend to want to co-opt my enemies and get them involved and become collaborators in the process because I think ultimately we end up with better access when we do that. But in Austin, Texas, the VSA Arts Organization, working with one of the local theater chains, has basically made a commitment to fundraising about $7,000 towards purchasing the WGBH rear window system for the theater chains in Austin, and the theater management has committed to providing the other half of the funding. And that's going to get Austin, Texas, some very accessible movie theaters that will have not only captioning available for first-run films, but also will provide audio description for those first-run films as well. I think it's a hard sell. There's a lot of debate right now in the Audio Description International listserv, which is an organization that was set up to promote audio description, about how it's best to get things like captioning and audio description into movie theaters, DVDs as well. And nobody has come up with a really good solution. I think that that co-opting your enemies and trying to get some sort of a collaboration going is an excellent way to do that, but I don't really have a good answer to that question. Do you, Peter?
Well, the Access Board has some excellent technical assistance material on their website with regards to different captioning systems. But I think your idea of collaboration is excellent. As you say, getting your, you know, quote unquote enemies, making them stakeholders in what you're trying to do is very effective. Crystal, can we go ahead and have our next question, please?
Our next question comes from the line of Tom Denniston.
Go ahead, Tom.
I think we're on the line.
Yes, go ahead.
Betty, Tom Denniston in Colorado Springs. I don't have any questions. I only have two tips. One is, for the nervous speaker to a microphone, Arthur Godfrey says, if you can imagine a favorite listener, put that picture right in front of the microphone. If not, bring a picture of somebody you like to talk to and put them in front of the microphone. My other tip has to do with printing in Braille. One of the things we were able to do here was we have a Colorado school for the blind that always needs Braille printers, and we had a city who was always crabbing because they didn't want to spend money for a Braille printer just for the few times that they need Braille information. So we got the two together, and they have an arrangement where the city bought the printer, and the printer stays at the school for the blind or the blind organization, except when the city needs something Braille, they get top priority. That's all I have. Thanks for being there. We appreciate you. I used to go to the Kennedy Center for about 10 years until I moved out of D.C.
That's great. I think that kind of collaboration where you can get government and nonprofit or government education or education and nonprofit working together is an excellent way to approach providing accommodations. Everybody won in that situation. I was lucky because the Kennedy Center already had the Braille software and equipment when I came on 4 years ago, but I know that I encourage other theaters in the Washington, D.C. area to call me when they need things Brailled, and I will train their volunteers, and they are welcome to come over and use my equipment anytime they want to make their materials accessible through Braille.
Excellent. Go ahead, Crystal, with our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Mona McAleese. Ms. McAleese, your line is open.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Betty, for facilitating this training for us. I'm calling from Anchorage, Alaska.
Excellent.
We are in the infancy through our Performing Arts Center up here of obligations, effective communication, the whole work. And I would like to ask, Betty, what is your budget for the year as a huge performing arts center, as a Kennedy Center? You're such a large center. What does your budget entail?
I'm not going to put specific dollars to it because I will hear this big old round of boos going on. I admit right off the bat that I have the luxury of having an endowment that supports accessibility programs at the Kennedy Center. My budget includes a lot more than just hiring sign language interpreters and paying for assistive listening equipment. It includes several national programs, including a national internship program that we administer on the part of the National Endowment for the Arts. And can I do a brief plug here? At the end of September or October, beginning of October, please be contacting me. This is an awards program that the Kennedy Center runs whereby we give out up to $15,000 to arts and cultural organizations to bring on an intern or a mentee with a disability. And that money is available. Last year we funded 10 organizations. The year before we funded 18. I'm hoping we'll be able to do the same thing this year. So I'm not going to tell you what my overall budget is. It wouldn't be getting to the point that you need, which is how much do we spend on the actual accommodations. Honestly, to do all of the interpreting that we provide here at the Kennedy Center, and please keep in mind, I have 8 theaters. We have 3,000 events a year, and I may be called upon to provide a sign language interpreter or two or even 3 at any one of those events. And so my budget for sign language interpreters is usually around $20,000 or $30,000 a year. That's not going to be the amount of dollars that you might need to do an 8-show season for a regional repertory company.
Thank you very much. I don't think that's very large at all. That's great.
I've worked many deals in my lifetime with the sign language interpreters in town.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Mona, and kudos to Region 10 for their promotion of today's session and getting participation from Anchorage, Alaska. Crystal, can we go ahead and have our next question, please?
Yes, sir. Our next question comes from the line of Mary Ann Cohen. Ms. Cohen, your line is open.
You had a question, Chip. Hi, this is Richard Lane. I'm the company manager and new facilities coordinator for Ballet West.
I'm participating as part of a group from Salt Lake City, and within this group there are two other dance companies, Ryer Woodbury and Repertory Dance Theater. And number two, because we are going on tour to Colorado Springs this year, hello Colorado Springs, and we have been to Anchorage, Alaska, and I know that the Kennedy Center presents dance. Have you found anything that's effective for dance?
Effective for making dance more accessible to people with
yes.
disabilities?
Yes.
Like captioning, Betty.
Yes.
This is Marianne.
Hi, Marianne. Captioning for dance, I would do it if there's a component of the dance that's aural. In other words, I got a request last year to do a ballet of Cinderella that one of our local ballet companies was doing, and I called the ballet company and I grilled them on what the music was and whether there was singing lyrics, because without the lyrics or the singing, captioning isn't providing anything. You can't caption something that doesn't have words. You can't sign language interpret something that doesn't have words. So if we are doing a dance where it involves lyrics, or it has a component worked into it that has a poem that's read, then I provide interpreting or captioning.
Were you, Marianne, in the group in Salt Lake City, were you also talking about audio description of the...
Probably. I mean, all three companies do student performances and do special performances for impaired people. It really is only an issue, I would guess, if they are visually impaired, because I understand that audible impaired people can still sense the music and see the movement. So it really only has to do with those who are visually impaired.
Okay.
There's another question from the table.
So that's different than captioning or interpreting, which, again, if it's a school performance and there's a teaching component to it, like the dancers are going to stop in the middle of a performance and explain what they're doing or talk about what they're doing, I certainly would be more than happy to provide interpreters or captioning for my patrons who are deaf or hard of hearing. For patrons who are blind, yes, certainly, audio description would work nicely for that. There are a lot of describers who enjoy doing dance. There's a lot of debate in the audio description world over what type of terminology is appropriate for use in dance. How technical do you get? Do you use technical terms, a jeté? Will the blind community understand those terms? So if you have the ability to audio describe a dance performance, I would encourage that.
Excellent. Let's go ahead and we'll take your last question from Salt Lake City. Nope, we lost. They're down. Okay. Well, they can get back in the queue. But providing audio description for something like that, Betty, obviously your describers would need to have some advance to be able to work on terminology and before being able to provide that description.
So you always want to have a rehearsal period whenever you have that ability. We don't take actors and hand them a script and tell them to come back in 24 hours and perform a show. So we don't do that with our audio describers or with our sign language interpreters or with our captioners. We want them to rehearse and practice and support the performance. So, yes, definitely you want to have your describers rehearsed for the show that they're going to be describing.
Good, good. Crystal, next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Daryl Christensen. Mr. Christensen, your line is open.
Hi, Betty. It's Alan Pruitt from Phoenix Theater. Great to hear your voice again, even if I can't see you. Thank you for the wonderful conference a couple of weeks ago. I appreciate it. My question is concerning the curb-to-seat service that you provide. Really simply, how do they access that service? Is that also an advance registration or request, or is it something that you just your doorman just watch for?
The curb to seat service is available an hour before every performance at the Kennedy Center. It is not something that a patron has to request in advance or arrange for in advance. We just staff the doorman in such a way that there's always one or two, depending on how many performances are going on in the building, who are there to help get people from the curb to their seat. We try to make all of our accommodations and accessibility services, whenever possible, invisible. And by that, I don't mean that we hide them or are ashamed of them. I mean that they should just be there at all times. That's equitable. I can walk to the theater. I can get into the building. I can find my way to my seat. A patron who is blind or has low vision, a patron who's using a wheelchair that they've borrowed from us, may not have the ability to get from point A to point B, and so we want to make the accommodation invisible, always there, always available, without having that patron have to make extra phone calls to arrange it.
Great.
I have a question as well.
Go ahead.
This is Tony DiRienzi from the Independent Living Center. I'd like to know, how have you resolved issues between artistic sensibilities and accommodations that may the performers or directors may find imposing upon their creativity?
Boy, you guys like to ask the tough ones, don't you? And put me on the spot. I'm a theater person at heart. I wanted to be in the theaters ever since I was 5 years old, and I love theater, and I love the product, and I understand it when people, directors, actors, are resistant to accessibility and accommodations, especially those that are visible. For example, audio description really is an invisible service. The director, the actor, really never even knows it's going on. Sign language interpreting and captioning are very visible. There's no way that we can hide those or pretend they're not there. So the way the Kennedy Center resolves that issue is we do it through contract. Basically, in every contract with every artist or producing company that comes through the Kennedy Center or that rents space in the Kennedy Center, there's this really inobtrusive paragraph that most of them don't read, and then they're very surprised when I invoke it, that basically says that if you're going to do anything in the Kennedy Center, you agree to comply with all federal laws and legislation that apply to the Kennedy Center. And so when I do get an artist or a producer or a company who says, no, we don't want that sign language interpreter, first I go down there and I try to schmooze them, and I try to talk to them, and I try to explain to them how important this is and how we've built this relationship with our community, and there will be people in the audience who are just as eager to see their product as everybody else, and they need the interpreter to access it. But if I'm pushed to the wall, I'd smile a lot, and I say, it's in your contract.
Excellent. Thanks for your question, gentlemen. Crystal, go ahead and take our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brian Kodawa.
Hi, Betty. This is Sandy Cavanaugh at the New Heritage Theater Company in Boise, Idaho. And we are building a new theater complex. And my question for you is, as we develop this building and we're dealing with the issues, of we have a very strong policy of total accessibility. And my question refers to the distinctions and the differences between the captioned performance and sign language interpreted performances. If we are considering putting captioning devices in the theater and whether or not to deal with that expense up front, how do you feel that the two serve the community, and do you find yourself having to use both, or what are the distinctions between those that you run into?
This is a question where I really strongly recommend that you get to your community and get to them immediately and talk to them.
We do have an accessibility committee put together, but I was just wondering from a building standpoint.
All right. Well, sign language interpreting, there are three things that we do primarily for our deaf and hard of hearing community and patrons. One is assistive listening devices. Those serve people who probably have mild to moderate hearing losses very well. Okay, and then we do sign language interpreting, which serves the part of the deaf and hard of hearing community that is culturally deaf, that uses American Sign Language as a first language. But for all of these years, we've kind of forgot the middle, those people that have a more severe hearing loss that are not helped through the assisted listening devices, but who are not culturally deaf. They weren't raised with American Sign Language. They may have lost their hearing later on in life. They may have been raised oral. And captioning serves that middle community. And so there are two answers to your question. One is that we do all three of them because we see the need as being three distinct needs. Sign language interpreting doesn't help the person with the mild hearing loss or the person in the middle who doesn't know sign language. Assistive listening devices don't help the person who has a severe hearing loss, who considers themselves deaf. Captioning's kind of there in the middle. From an institutional perspective, the Kenney Center is committed to providing all three things. We can afford to do that. I think that when you're in a smaller community or you may be looking at issues of financing both of these things, you are going to have to start making some tough decisions, getting it down in writing how you reach those decisions, document the path you're taking, and talk to, and again, get your community involved, because they're not the same. One does not replace the other. And so if you are looking at that, you are looking at possibly cutting out a portion of the deaf and hard of hearing community from having access. If you do decide something like we are only going to provide sign language interpreters or we are only going to provide captioning, I would certainly have a policy in place whereby you state that you will provide interpreters if you're requested to provide them.
Great, thank you.
Thanks for the excellent question. That's a great distinction you made there, Betty, between the captioning and the sign language interpreters, because as you know, the law says effective communication and gives examples. It doesn't say what you have to provide. Ultimately, the entity has the call on what auxiliary aid or service they will provide, but it must be effective.
Right.
So choosing one over the other, if it's not effective for that particular person, doesn't meet the requirements. Excellent. Crystal, can we have our next question?
Yes, sir. Our next question comes from the line of Matt Norris. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi, Peter, Betty. My name is John Larkin. I'm the house manager at Indiana University Bloomington. I had a problem over the last year. I've noticed that for a large section in our lower orchestra seating area, we have approximately 3,200 seats in our hall. We have a whole bunch of seats that are wheelchair accessible that get sold and used, but what I've noticed happening at the end of the events is that all of the patrons in the wheelchairs are the last to leave, because the show gets over and the lights come up and everybody that have, their perfect use of their limbs get up and they head for the doors, and the folks that are using the wheelchairs get stuck. So I put a policy in place that I use all my volunteers and managers, and when the show gets done, we block the appropriate aisles and clear the center aisle, and then each wheelchair patron gets a one-person, one-on-one escort out into the foyer so they're not stuck till the end of the show, and it's caused a great deal of, it's made some waves with the patrons and the donors and the building, and with the other employees of the building. So I was kind of wondering how you would handle that. We have mainly one large accessibility ramp into the seating area. There are different ways in and out, but it's the one main ramp that most patrons prefer to use because it's the easiest way back into the foyer area to get concessions and restrooms, and it's the easiest way back to parking. So how would you kind of handle that?
Well, a couple different ways. One, I admire and respect your decision, and I do hope that you got some of your patrons who are wheelchair users involved in helping you reach that decision. But two, accessibility means an equal access, means that the person with a disability not only has a right to equally access the theater, but they also have the right to be equally inconvenienced. And a lot of us get stuck at the end of a really long line as we are waiting to get out of the theater, because when we all come into the theater, we're trickling in over a half hour, hour period of time, and when we leave the theater, everybody's trying to leave in 2 minutes. So in general, I think you're dealing with two issues. One is, are you really inconveniencing the patron who's a wheelchair user by their having to wait to get out? In other words, do other people also wait to get out? And then the second one is, maybe there's some real issues why a person with a disability may want to get out earlier. Their disability may mean that they have to use the bathroom more frequently than I do. And so being stuck at the end of a long line really would be a barrier to their participation, so you might want to work that out. So I would be reluctant to block accesses, exit aisles for emergency evacuation purposes, but I would also be reluctant to assume that the person who's a wheelchair user needs that level of accommodation that you're providing. I would make it be a one-on-one case. That's what we do here with our ushers. When we have a person who's a wheelchair user who's been escorted into the theater by an usher, that usher checks back with them at intermission and at the end of the show to ask if they want to have an escort out as well. And that leaves the decision up to the individual patron.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome, John. Crystal, our next question, please.
Yes, our next question comes from Marcia Cassidy. Your line is open.
Hello, this is Peg Gutzel in Cincinnati for Marcy today. And we have in Cincinnati a number of grand older buildings as well as some new ones where we enjoy the arts. And there are some circumstances where lower-priced seating may block access to such things as open captioning or sign language interpretation. We wondered how you handle that at the Kennedy Center, or if you do. And then if we have enough time, we have an usher question after this.
I'm going to ask you to clarify that question. Are you, you're talking about a discounted ticket?
Yes, we're talking about the fact that the lower priced seats that most patrons have access to may not work for a person who needs open captioning. How do you handle that?
Okay, I understand now. In general, the Americans with Disabilities Act does not require me as a theater to discount my tickets, but a lot of theaters have discount ticket programs, and they develop the discount ticket program for a couple of different reasons. One is that they are compensating for lack of choice in an older theater. If you can only sit in the back row, but you don't have an option to sit in the front or the middle or the sides or the balcony, I may decide to have a discounted ticket program to compensate that individual for lack of choice. Okay. The same thing applies in a situation where you're working with captioning and sign language interpreting. For the person to be able to access the captioning and the interpreting, they may have to sit in a particular area. And yes, frequently that area is in the most expensive seats in the theater because frequently that area is down front orchestra level. And in that case, you may want to decide to have a policy in place that says because the deaf individual or the hard of hearing individual doesn't have access to choice, they can't choose to sit anyplace else in the theater. They have to sit in this one area. Because of that, our policy is to make those tickets be half price or make those tickets be the same price as the lowest price ticket in the theater. The Kennedy Center's policy is to do just that. When we have interpreted or captioned performances where the deaf patron must sit in a specific area in order to access the interpreting and the captioning, we discount those tickets to a half price, which is usually about the same price as the lowest price ticket in the house. But in general, I wouldn't leap at discounted ticket programs. For example, in the concert hall here at the Kennedy Center, we used to discount tickets for wheelchair users because there was only one place in the theater where they could sit. Once the concert hall was renovated, we had dispersed an integrated seating, wheelchair accessible seating, throughout the theater and in all price levels and on all levels of the theater. So we discontinued the discounted ticket program in that theater.
That would make sense to us. What we were concerned about is the situation that you just described when there is no choice.
When there is no choice, again, the law, as I understand it, doesn't force you to discount your ticket, but I would recommend discounting tickets in that situation because you are compensating for lack of choice. You really aren't up to the requirement in the law that talks about dispersed and integrated seating.
Right, right, and we'll get to your second question in 1 second here. And Betty, again, a theme that I keep hearing you say is policy development and
right.
Having a policy in place to deal with different requests, different situations, and it is somewhat of a safeguard for the entity to demonstrate that that they've put some time and effort into a particular situation and how they're going to deal with it, rather than having an ad hoc policy.
Right. I don't believe in offering discount tickets as a charity.
Right.
You know, out of pity for people, but I do think that there are situations where offering a discounted ticket makes sense because that patron doesn't have the degree of choice as other patrons.
That makes a lot of sense to us here.
Excellent. Go ahead with your usher question if you have that.
The second question, we noticed that you said very early on, Betty, that your ushers bring and give the assistive listening equipment to patrons. And most of the arrangements that we are familiar with involve patrons having to go to a window or a booth and acquire them there. But we were really interested in the arrangement that you described. Can you talk a little bit more about how you manage that?
Sure. I don't want to misstate it. We actually do provide assistive listening assistive listening devices distribution in two different ways. In our larger theaters, which are the three theaters on our main level, we do ask the patrons to go to a central distribution point, which is in each of the halls closest to each of the theaters. So the patron on their way into the theater will stop at a desk and they get their assistive listening device there at that desk. However, we have four smaller theaters, and in those theaters, we found it almost impossible to identify a central distribution point because the theaters are scattered all over the building, and they were not very close to any of the main distribution points on the main level. So what we started to do was to have the ushers each night, one or two of the ushers in the theater are designated as the access ushers, and they are responsible for stopping and picking up equipment, the assistive listening devices, before they go up to their assignment. And they usually grab 5 to 10 units. So if you've got two people and they've each got 5 to 10 units, you have between 10 and 20 units in a theater that seats 300 to 400 people. So that's a lot. And they shove them in their coat pockets, which thank goodness are really big. And when a patron requests an assistive listening device, they just hand it out of their pocket.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
All right, Crystal, can we have our next question, please?
Yes. Our next question comes from the line of Barb Chapman. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. We're wondering, do you have alternative size seating, for instance, chairs with no arms, double-sized chairs?
Boy, our patrons would wish that we had that. You know, like the airlines, theater seats seem to be getting narrower and narrower. What we do provide are chairs with no arms on them. And those usually do accommodate our patrons who are larger. So the answer to the question is, yes, we do provide chairs that have no arms. I haven't ever measured them, so I couldn't swear to you that they're a few inches wider than the regular theater chair.
Okay, thank you. Could we ask one more quick question?
Sure.
Okay, if the patron is deaf, do you have any general information on what's the best seating for that person, stage left, stage right?
I'm going to ask you to be more specific in the question. Deaf and they're using sign language interpreters, deaf and they're using captioning, deaf and they're using assistive listening devices, deaf and they're not using any equipment at all.
Sign language interpreter.
There isn't really a best side. What you're trying to do when you decide where to position your sign language interpreters is to select a place in the theater where the interpreter can be seen at the same time that the stage is seen without the deaf patron having to ping pong back and forth between the interpreter and the stage. So I face a lot of times with shows coming in from the outside the situation where I'll put the interpreter where we normally put our interpreters, which is in our larger theater, they have four aisles, two side aisles, which are against a wall, and then two center aisles, hence creating three distinct seating areas in the orchestra. And we always put the interpreter in the center aisle, at the bottom of the center aisle with their back up against the stage. And the companies that come in will frequently say, oh, no, the interpreter can't be there. They have to be over there in the corner. In other words, at the bottom of the aisle that's against the wall. And again, I smile really sweetly and say, no, this is where the interpreters go. This is where we put them at the Kennedy Center because we have a commitment to our deaf audience that they will be able to see the interpreter and the stage clearly and at the same time. But in terms of left, right, center, it's going to vary depending on the type of set. Sometimes we get the interpreters on stage because there's no place for them in the audience. Sometimes on stage is the best place for them. Sometimes a little bit more left, a little bit more right is better. For Sheer Madness, we tend to put them almost center. But we know that in advance when we're selling the tickets. And again, the commitment is to our deaf audience that they're going to have the ability to have effective communication and see the stage at the same time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Crystal, next question, please.
Yes, our next question comes from Cheryl Turner. Your line is open.
Go ahead, Cheryl. Oh, Cheryl? I guess Cheryl has changed her mind. Can we get her next one, Crystal, please?
Yes, I'm going to make the announcement one more time.
Sure.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the 1 at this time.
Betty,
yeah.
Could you talk just a little bit about your start at the Kennedy Center when you first arrived there? What general advice could you provide to someone just stepping into a position similar to yours? What are the first things they need to do?
They have to be perky. I'm telling you. I think that one of the reasons why I was able to be as successful as I am here at the Kennedy Center is that I go in and I am friendly. I take the time to educate people. I'm never, never too busy to stop and talk to other staff members, and they bring me a lot of their questions and issues now, sometimes not even related to the Kennedy Center. I get frequent questions about, you know, my mother is losing her vision and she loves to play cards. Where can we get large print playing cards? I have an aunt who's visiting and she's a wheelchair user. Which one of the monuments in D.C. are accessible? And I don't mean for that to sound trite, but I really do think that the relationship building that we need to do when we're in charge of accessibility is the most important part of our job. Because if you can educate people and get them on your side, co-opt them, you're going to get a lot further. The other thing that's really helpful is you have got to have the support of upper management. Because without the support of my boss, who's the senior vice president of the Kennedy Center and the president of the Kennedy Center, there you can't get anywhere. It's like running your head up against a brick wall. So that's really the first thing that I would recommend people do when they come in is advocate for accessibility, but advocating from within an institution is very different than the kind of advocating you do when you're outside of an institution looking in.
Sure. Crystal, did we have any more questions from the audience?
Yes, sir. Our next question comes from the line of Matt Norris. Your line is open.
Hi, Betty Peter. John Larkin from Bloomington, Indiana, back again. We offer audio description for our Broadway shows, and one problem that I've had in the past is when we get a request for audio description, our describers, 9 times out of 10, want me to track down some kind of transcript or video or something for them to preview before they come to the show, so they haven't done it cold. Especially for the shows we bring in that aren't mainstream that maybe they haven't seen before. And I've been having just a really hard time tracking down any of that stuff with a lot of Broadway shows. You know that with copyright law, they can't have video circulating, and there's no script you can get except when the show gets to your building. Do you have any advice on how I could track down that preview information for the describers better than I do?
One is, again, go back to your contracts and make sure that from the get-go in every one of your contracts it specifies that the producing company will provide you with those things. Now, you may not win on the videotape, but you should be able to get a copy of a script. Because there are issues of union and equity, and that's one of those battles that I just decided I couldn't fight. I didn't think I would win it, so I haven't tried to fight it. However, there may be other arts organizations that have those resources, and one thing I would recommend is that you look up Audio Description International on the Internet, and their listserv can be very verbose. They get very passionate about a lot of issues, but they are also the people that are doing audio description across the nation, and they may have already done the show before it's coming to you, and they may have materials that they can loan you. So that's one way of going about it. Two ways. One is to get it into the contract so that the company has to provide it to you contractually. And two would be to find the other audio describers that have seen the show or who the theaters that have had the show before you get it. See if they can loan you the resources.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. Betty, how important is it to for someone in a smaller theater that may not get requests for accommodations all the time to have to at least have a resource list of where to go when they get those requests?
That's really important. The ignorance of the law is not an excuse. And so the one thing that I find very frustrating is when I get a call from a theater and they say, oh my heavens, we just got a request for a sign language interpreter, and what do we do? And they want it for tomorrow. And I usually try to get them in touch with sign language interpreters, and then I usually encourage them right then and there to have a policy. You don't have to provide sign language interpreters for every show, every performance, every production, but you should have a policy in place that says if we get a request for a sign language interpreter for audio description, for any of these other effective communication and auxiliary aids for Braille, you should have a policy and a procedure in place that says, should we get this request, we are happy to do that, you know, within the period of time that we've researched. Don't make the time frame up. Okay. In other words, I think 4 weeks is enough time. You know, you need to have said, I called the interpreting agencies in my area, and they all told us that with 2 weeks' notice, they could provide us with a sign language interpreter. And then to have those resources at your fingertips are great. If you have the time as a small theater to develop, you know, a list of sign language interpreters, audio describers, places you can get Braille, places that will help you with your large print, that's great. But chances are you don't have that time and you don't have the resources. So better off, I think, are to develop people. In other words, know who to call. I know there's self-help for the hard of hearing in my area. I'll call them when an issue comes up that I need to provide an accommodation for somebody who's hard of hearing. So I think the policy is really important, and then I think having a couple good resources at your fingertips, like your independent living center, they are great resources.
Sure.
To call.
Your regional ADA centers.
Oh, yeah, the DivTechs. I forgot the DivTechs and your DivTechs. You know, the reason why I don't think about the DivTechs is because they're regional. They cover more than just your local city.
Sure.
Whereas I can call my mayor's committee. And
right.
Probably they know the real local stuff.
But the policy. You develop the policy, and you know, someone may leave that theater company, but the policy stays behind.
And
the person that comes in has those, you know, those contacts where to go.
It's important to have institutional knowledge. When I came here in 1999, the person who had been the accessibility manager had actually left in 98. In that time, between her being there and my coming in, which was about a 6-month, 8-month period of time, all of her files got erased. Yep. All of her materials got thrown away. And the institution lost this wealth of knowledge. So policies, written procedures, things like that are a file, a book, something that says, you know, accommodations and access are really important because you don't want to lose all that just because one person leaves.
Sure. Crystal, do we have any more questions from the audience?
Yes, sir. The next question comes from the line of Martha White. Your line is open.
Hi. We have a question from our Springfield location.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Hi. This is Marilyn Selby, and I'm with the city's Department of Community Relations. I tried to contact somebody from our local auditorium, but no one was able to come out there. So this is a follow-up to your the discussion we were having about discount tickets. We have a local auditorium theater that seats about 2,000 people, and while there is very limited integrated seating. So my question would be, if somebody who needed, and there is no integrated, there's no seating for people with disabilities in the balcony. So it's on the main floor and on the mezzanine. So if somebody needed a ticket in the higher price range, because of a disability, how would that go for the person who was accompanying that person, the partner, the spouse, the friend?
That's a good question. You know, when we provide dispersed and integrated seating and when we provide wheelchair accessible locations, it's the rules, the law is very specific, and it says we have to provide a companion seat immediately adjacent to that wheelchair location. And in general, I would strongly recommend that the wheelchair location and the companion seat be the same price. In other words, if you're going to discount the wheelchair location, then you discount the companion seat. Now, that always brings up the question about what about if you're coming with your family? I have a friend here who's a wheelchair user, and she comes to the theater with her husband and her son's friend. So now all of a sudden you've got a party of four. Do I discount all four seats? That's going to become a decision that you make on a case-by-case basis or on a theater-by-theater basis because, once again, remember, the law does not require me to discount a ticket, but it does require me to provide dispersed and integrated seating, and if I cannot do that, I may choose to discount tickets as compensation for the lack of the integrated and dispersed seating. At the Kenney Center, our policy is generally to sell the companion seat at the same price as the wheelchair location. And if we have a party that's larger than two, and INTIX, which is the International Ticketing Association, says that on average people go to the theater in parties of 2.5 individuals. And I've never figured out where that half of an individual comes from. But nonetheless, it indicates that on average there are people coming in groups larger than two. And in that case, at the Kenney Center, we make every effort to seat the entire party in the same area and adjacent to each other. If we can't do that, we make every effort to seat them as close as possible. But if we are discounting tickets, which we don't always do, but if we are in one of our theaters that hasn't been renovated and we're providing a discounted wheelchair location, I would discount the wheelchair location and the companion seat, but the other members of the party I would sell at full price.
Right.
Now, understand something. That's a decision and a policy of the Kennedy Center. You can't just pick up policies from one theater and blindly apply them to every other institution because theaters are all different, and the policies the Kennedy Center has developed are very specific to our situation. So it's a good idea to do what you're doing right now, which is asking what the Kennedy Center's policy is, but you've got to really think through whether that policy works within your institution and within the limits and the givens of your situation.
All right, because as you said, Betty, there is no specific DOJ guidance on theaters that don't have dispersed seating or access to all pricing levels. But again, reiterating the most important thing is to have a policy in place and to be able to demonstrate as a theater why you are charging a particular price for a seating location. When the Department of Justice doesn't require that if the only accessible seating is located in the most expensive section, that you provide that seat for the lowest price. But there should be some thought process put in a policy in place of how you arrived at the particular price that you as a theater are using.
Yeah. In general, I mean, I don't speak for the Department of Justice. Only they can speak for themselves, and they always say it depends. But my general impression has been from my conversations with people at the Department of Justice and from the various different mediations and letters of agreement that they've made with other entertainment venues is that they strongly favor a discounted ticket if you aren't able to provide that dispersed and integrated seating. In other words, their definition of dispersed and integrated is it dispersed and integrated in every price range? And so I would think through very carefully what your specific situation is, and if you really are only able to provide wheelchair locations in your most expensive seating area, I would strongly encourage you to consider some sort of a discount.
Thanks for the question, Mary. Crystal, do we have another question?
Yes, sir. Our next question comes from Michelle Dupre. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. My question has to do with your ticketing policy, whether you verify at all whether somebody has a disability or not. We have a couple arenas in Connecticut that require handicapped seat purchasers to purchase them in person to assure they have a disability. And we also have a couple of arenas that don't do any quality control, and much of the handicapped seating is occupied by non-wheelchair users or mobility-impaired individuals. I was wondering what your policy is regarding this.
Well, first I have to give you my philosophy. Again, we're shooting for equal access, and so I'm not asked if I'm able-bodied when I walk in the door, so I shouldn't be asking people if they have a disability. On the other hand, we try really hard to ensure that the people who need an accommodation are the ones who are actually getting it. So if you've got a limited number of wheelchair locations, yes, I want to try to do something that ensures that those wheelchair users get access to those seats. Paralyzed Veterans of America has some principles for seating policy that they've designed for stadiums. And in general, they support allowing the stadium to ask the person, you know, what the need is and to prove a disability in order to be able to get the wheelchair location. But I would say that requiring someone to come down in person to show the disability might be considered sort of a gray area, because as a person who doesn't use a wheelchair, I can order my tickets through the internet and over the phone.
Yes, exactly.
And so there becomes an equitability issue there. I want to just say that the theaters who do those kinds of policies really are trying their best to ensure that the wheelchair user gets what they need, and that the people who are not wheelchair users don't end up in those wheelchair locations. But I don't think that, personally, I don't approve of that policy. I would think of a better way to do it. The way the Kennedy Center does seating is when someone calls up and says to us, you know, I need a wheelchair location, we don't talk about the disability, we talk about what the need is. Oh, do you need a wheelchair location? Will the patron be transferring from their wheelchair or not? So we don't ever ask what the disability is, we ask what the need is. Will they transfer or not? Gives us a lot of information. Oh, they will be transferring. Oh, then you don't need necessarily a wheelchair accessible location. What you need is a location that someone using a wheelchair can get to without having to do seats. And so our policy is not to ask people what their disability is or to prove a disability in order to use an accommodation, but it is to ask questions about what people need, and we do it in such a way that we make it clear to our patrons that what we're trying to do is ensure that they get what they need and that they have, and that we're providing them with really good customer service. But I do know that in larger stadiums and arenas, this whole issue of whether you can ask for proof of disability has come up over and over again. There isn't any real clear guidance from the Department of Justice. PVA has supported the sort of the rights of the stadiums to ask for proof of disability, but I think it has to be reasonable.
Yeah, the stadium that requires you buy them in person is about 35 minutes out of the closest major city.
Yeah.
So it's not a place that's easily accessible for people with disabilities.
I think what you're describing is that they're an institution that needs some educating. I think that making you come down and buy the tickets in person is not equal access, because other people can buy their tickets other ways, and that they may be able to institute other ways of protecting those seats for the users who really need them. One way that stadiums do this is they leave the seat out of that space, the wheelchair location. So if you aren't a wheelchair user, then there's no seat in that space, and the ushers are instructed to reseat people.
Yeah.
That's one way. Again, looking at issues of need, do you need that? Or if you are going to ask for proof of disability, then I would certainly ask for different – I would try to figure out different ways that someone can prove their disability to me.
Right, and before entities go about asking for proof, it may be advisable to request a clarification or some type of interpretation from the Department of Justice before requiring people to demonstrate or prove a disability when requesting accessible seating.
Yeah, it's a catch-22, Peter. I really think it is for the theaters and the stadiums.
Mm-hmm.
We are trying to do the right thing by ensuring that our patrons with disabilities get the accommodations that are available to them. And at the same time, we don't have any real way of ensuring that the person has a disability. We just have to take them on faith. Here at the Kennedy Center, we just take people on faith, to tell the truth. If they say they have a disability, they've got it, we'll provide the accommodation. But then people aren't usually scamming us to get tickets to see the opera.
Right.
Whereas people may be scamming to get tickets to see KISS.
To go there.
You know, or some big concert venue. So I think that this is a situation where the local advocacy group and the venues need to really work together to come up with good policies and ways to handle it.
Absolutely. Crystal, do we have one more question we can sneak in before the bottom of the hour?
Yes. Our next question comes from Lois Eubank. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. This is Susan Domer from Indiana University, Purdue University in Fort Wayne. Last year, we made the commitment to be as accessible as possible, and we're thrilled with what we've put into place. Now we need some suggestions on how we can further market those services and advertise those services in our community. We've tried several different options, and I think we're looking for any other information you can give us. We know that sometimes people with disabilities are waiting to see if the program is successful in a long term, and I'm wondering what your opinions are about that. And then we have another question.
In terms of marketing, I think that's the thing that's the hardest for most theaters to face. First off, one, I would start to broaden your definition of who's a person with a disability, because you probably actually do have a lot of people with disabilities using your services and coming to your theaters. You just don't consider them to be the traditional person with who's using a wheelchair or the person with the guide dog, but you may have a lot of people with mobility impairments that are invisible or visual impairments that you can't see that are actually taking advantage of the services. But in terms of marketing, there's two things that you need to do. One is you need to get it into absolutely everything that you produce that's aimed at the general market. So if you're doing advertising in the newspaper, there needs to be a line in there that says something like, "We are accessible. We want you." In your brochures, you have to have a statement that says, "We're accessible, we want you." And then you want to do targeted marketing, where you go to the disability community, and this is the hard part because it takes a long time to win the confidence of people with disabilities, is my experience. Too many times they've had things offered to them and then it's yanked back, or somebody very well-intentioned comes and says, "Oh, we've done all these wonderful things for you," and then when they go to experience it, the experience is bad. So you have to have patience. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep going there and going there and going there. And I tell you, the one thing I found is that people trust people more than they trust an ad. And so I take every opportunity I can get to go and talk to every group that asks me.
Yeah, we also liked your suggestion about the email and the listserv. That's what we're going to start trying to do this year, is to get individual email addresses of people who have an interest in these services.
Email's great. It's been very effective with the deaf and hard of hearing community. I can give you an example. We did an interpretive performance of a stand-up comedian 2 years ago before I'd started the email listservs, the email broadcasts. And I sold maybe 5-6 seats.
Mm-hmm.
We did another stand-up comedian this year. I've been doing the email broadcast. I put it in for 3 months running, and I sold out all 20 of my seats in my deaf section.
Great.
So I think email is very effective.
We also had a question in regard to service animals and the type of accommodations. Actually, I'm going to hand the phone to Lois.
Hello. My question has to do with service animals. Do you see patrons with service animals separate from your other patrons? So in case somebody has like allergies to the dogs and all of a sudden there's this big dog sitting at their feet?
No, we don't. Patrons with service animals can sit anywhere in the theater. If there's a patron sitting close to them that has a fear of that animal or an allergy to that animal, we relocate that patron.
Excellent. Thanks for your question, Lois. And, Betty, I don't know that you were telling the truth when you said you were nervous at the beginning. You provided us with some excellent information and excellent presentation, and we truly appreciate the time and effort you've given us today. You've been provided some excellent information. And to all of you listening to us, again, the 10 regional ADA centers who collaborate to provide you the ADA Distance Learning Series, truly appreciate your commitment and your attendance for these distance learning sessions. And I'd like to especially thank Indiana for their participation, the state of. Please contact your ADA center to get more information about the September 16th session on best practices in accessible electronic and information technology policy. Please stay tuned to your regional ADA center to find out information about the 2003-2004 ADA Distance Learning Series, which will kick off in October. And once again, thank you to all of you for participating, and have a nice afternoon.
Peter, are you there?
Yeah.
This concludes our ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the conference. You may now disconnect and have a good day.